Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century, decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
Kick it, scalp it, or bash it with a baseball bat. We will be cruel to the nominees, and through our cruelty, they will know who we are. Today's movie is Inglourious Basterds, directed by Quentin Tarantino. Here's the trailer.
Ten hot!
I'm putting together a special team. We're going to be doing one thing and one thing only. Killing Nazis.
Sound good?
Yes, sir!
I'm going to assume you know who we are.
Everybody in the German army's heard of you.
You probably heard we ain't in the prisoner-taking business. We in the killing Nazi business. And cousin, business is booming. If you ever want to eat a sauerkraut sandwich again, take your wiener schnitzel they can finger and point out on this map what I want to know.
I respectfully refuse.
Hey, Donnie! Guy's German here, wants to die for country. Oblige him.
An American Secret Service outfit lives deep behind enemy lines. The Germans call them the Bastards. These Yanks have been them the devil.
We're all tickled to hear you say that.
Germans are throwing a gala premiere. In attendance will be most of the German high command.
You'll rendezvous with our double agent. She'll take it from there.
You're getting us in that premiere.
That's suicide.
What else are we gonna do? Go home?
So what's the plan? We punch those goons out, take their machine guns, and burst in there, blast them.
Is that the plan?
That's about it. Or not.
Something you don't know. Hitler is attending the premiere.
Getting a whack Uncle Adolf makes this a horse of different color.
We have all our rotten eggs in one basket. The objective of the operation, blow up the basket.
I want to give you a little something you can't take off.
You're getting pretty good at that. And are in the hands of the SS. My hands, to be exact.
Yes.
You like sauerkraut, Brian?
Not really, no.
Ooh, mustard?
Yeah, I do. I'll do mustard on a hot dog.
Okay, wiener schnitzel?
I don't know if I ever had it.
What? Pretzels?
Yeah, not bad.
All right.
Anything else? My question to you is this Mike Myers' best movie?
I don't know why he's in this, and it's the worst scene in the movie. I really just don't get it.
There's a few of those like little weird cameos in here. Okay, so this movie was made for $70 million, made $321 million.
Nice.
That's a lot of money for
a lot of money.
Bloody Quentin Tarantino movie. Tarantino said that he didn't misspell the title to differentiate from the 1978 movie by the same name or a very similar name. He said it was a creative decision.
Hmm.
That he initially refused to explain, but he did say that Bastards was spelled as such because, quote, that's just the way you say it, unquote.
But the whole thing is moot because this is a fictional depiction.
That's true. It's moot. He later also said that the misspelled title is a Basquiat-esque touch, sort of like modern art. Do you think that the misspelled title is basically a modern art move?
I don't know what it is. I don't know Basquiat. Maybe I'm ignorant there.
You should look up Basquiat.
I guess so.
He's great. The German version of this is 50 seconds longer than the American. I was wondering if you got that German extended version or stuck with the American.
I didn't, but there's a featurette about it on the Blu-ray that I did watch. So I saw a bunch of clips.
Rotten Tomatoes 89, Metacritic 69. I was kind of surprised. That's a little low for Metacritic.
Ridiculous.
The cinema score was an A-. And the best measurement of all is, of course, 8 to 11 minutes standing O at Cannes.
These standing ovations.
8 to 11 minutes. Now, I want to know who decides when it is over, because someone thought it was 8 minutes,
yeah,
and someone thought it was 11. Does that mean, like, some dude in the back row is still up there, so, like, it keeps going?
Some just people boost, are filing out.
Just but to they're... boost the standing O score, someone is out there, like, paid by Quentin Tarantino, potentially. Coming up in the show, we'll talk. We'll do questions, talk trivia, keep it or kick it.
Okay, so we both know that this is going to come up, so I'm just going to dive right in right off the bat here. You have the tendency to get caught up on facts in movies that are based on real events.
I do.
This is a movie that's set during a real event with a lot of liberties taken, and those liberties...
Liberties?
There are some liberties.
What liberties?
Those liberties, I think, are a lot of the movie's point, but I'm curious how that sits with you. Are you able to get over the fact that this is a revisionist take, or are the inconsistencies distracting?
I don't know if this question is ironic.
It's not ironic.
It's not ironic. Well, to me, revisionist history is very honest. I love it. I'm all about it. I'm all about, like, I'm not, we're not claiming, he's not claiming that this is like a documentary.
But no,
Hitler dies.
I don't understand though. No movie claims that it's a documentary.
I know.
Unless it is a documentary.
But you don't screw around with major facts like that and say, it's a true story, and then Hitler dies. Hitler doesn't die in a fiery, you know, inferno in a movie theater in real life. So if you're saying that this is, I mean, it's revisionist, it's an alternative history, it's speculative fiction. I'm all about that. That's cool with me.
I guess the difference is, in some weird way, I see all feature films as revisionist history.
I can understand that. If it's
a movie, then it becomes fiction. If it's a documentary, it's nonfiction.
It's the intention, though. The intention is to make this like, you are going to be sitting in the room with, name the celebrity. No, Marilyn Monroe. I haven't seen Blonde yet. Have you seen Blonde?
Not yet, no.
So I've heard that that's kind of like, it's taking a lot of liberties, right? I don't know. If you're sitting in the room with Abraham Lincoln, and it's like, we're trying to make this be exactly like it. But, you know, he actually is wearing a cowboy hat just because we like cowboy hats better than top hats. Like, why do that? That's what I don't like. But if you're saying like, this is like a weird, freaky version of Abraham Lincoln, and he's down there with his top hat and a Hawaiian shirt on, and there's some kind of strange irony going on, and like, this is, now we're talking, okay, now this is postmodernism. Okay, now I'm good with that.
I would like to see him in an Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah.
I think if we can
played
make that
by Daniel
happen,
Day-Lewis.
Yeah. That would make it even better. But rewatching this time, I kept thinking about myth-making and this idea of mythologizing. This was in the front of my head, especially in the first three chapters. So the first chapter, I just want to do a breakdown here, the first three chapters. The first chapter is when we meet Christoph Waltz as Landa, and he goes to this farmhouse, and he asks the guy, do you know my nickname? They talk about his nickname for a while. You know, do you know how I got this name? What am I known for? He asks him that. And he says he's proud of this reputation because he earned it. And then he lets one of the girls who are hiding underneath the floorboards escape, theoretically, I think, to spread the word on what happened here, basically to contribute to that myth of his nickname. The Jew Hunter is his nickname. Then in chapter two, we meet Aldo. It's Brad Pitt. And he talks all about the German will fear us, you know, through our cruelty, they will know who we are. And just like Landa, he lets one Nazi live to spread the reputation of what happened there. And by extension, his reputation. I think it's also worth noting that he doesn't let that Nazi guy leave without putting that swastika
mark on him.
Scar on him. That's a, you know, a signifier of what he has done that he can't, that's permanent, that he can't get rid of. And then in chapter three, we get to know Shoshana, the one who escaped from the farmhouse, a little bit more. And she's
the one who inherited the movie theater.
Yeah. Yes. So she owns a movie theater. And just by virtue of that setting, now we're talking about movies, how they contribute to myth-making and mythologizing. And she meets a Nazi in that scene who is super famous now because of being a sniper
the
and
movie,
stuck in a clock tower. And people know him because he killed a bunch of people, and now they're making a movie about him, and then he's becoming a myth. So, I mean, that was really interesting to me because Yes, I thought about the revisionist angle of this a lot the first few times I watched it. You can't watch this and not think about that. But I don't think I thought of it so much in terms of reputation and myth, and how kind of making a movie like this is almost a statement in itself that this is almost how we want to remember the past, not actually how it happened, that facts are not really important.
I didn't really connect the alternative history with the movie thread, but that's very interesting. It's definitely a movie that I feel like I could watch another 5 times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is, you know, confirming that there's a whole lot going on here. Tarantino said that when he set out to make it, he felt like this was going to be his masterpiece, which of course,
and then he says it, last line of the movie,
what?
This just might be my masterpiece. It's like the true. Most swagger line of all time. That's how he ends the movie. It's kind of ridiculous, but then I also sort of love it.
I love it. Brad Pitt is so over the top in this movie. It's sort of like the exact opposite of Brad Pitt and Benjamin Button, you know?
Thank God.
Although I feel like Burn After Reading was a nice bridge somehow to get here. But
was he nominated for this? Because I know that
I don't know.
I know that Christoph Waltz was. And he's great.
He is.
I love him. But man, Pitt is good in
Brad
this.
Brad Pitt is good in this. I think so. Here's the line that made me think about the same idea. So in that first scene when you meet Brad Pitt, Aldo Rain. He says a line that also, because you know that Tarantino is interested in movies, you know, it's like worshiping movies almost. Brad Pitt's character says, "Watching him beat Nazis is the closest we get to going to the movies."
Mm-hmm.
And it almost beats me over the head with it when I'm watching this, because I know that he's interested already in the idea. But also, movie violence, you know, is kind of like on his mind a lot, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much violence are we, what does the violence do for us, to us, mm-hmm. you know, both of those things. And watching him beat Nazis is the closest we get to going to the movies. What does that mean?
Man, this idea of how we are supposed to respond to the violence in this movie is something that I really rolled over a lot in my mind. It's the second question that I was going to ask you about also, because it's strange. The bastards are so brutal throughout this whole movie, and they're doling this brutality out to Nazis, who are like the easiest target in order to do stuff like that too, and not have to feel bad about it.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's like celebratory. It's like we're avenging, you know, past wrongs by, you know, remembering history our way. And like there are this band of Jewish people who are able to fight back and, you know, give it to them. But then we see the nation's pride guy, the Nazi who was the sniper in the watchtower, and he's glorified and he's on screen now. He's an actor. He's a real soldier
playing himself.
He's an actor playing himself in a movie. And when we see him actually watching the movie, this is after we'd already heard the stories that are aggrandizing, and we see strangers shaking his hand in the streets and they're celebrating him. We're watching the scene in the movie theater, and even as people are laughing and cheering all around him, he's squirming.
Hitler is busting a gut.
but that guy who this story is based on is squirming.
Yep.
He looks like he has some PTSD thing going on, mm-hmm. which is weird because the rest of the movie doesn't really deal with violence in a real way like that. It's always kind of, it's movie violence, not real violence where there are real repercussions. It's very complicated.
It is. And that it all culminates to me with one of the most memorable scenes. I would say one of the most memorable shots of the decade. The movie screen where Shoshana is huge. It's going up in flames,
mm-hmm.
and she has just died.
Yep.
So she, in a weird way, survives as a movie herself.
Yep. And we see the same thing with him after she shoots him up in the projecting
booth.
And
he's up there, yeah.
We see his face on there, and he's kind of looking sad, almost.
The twisting around what Tarantino is doing here is just, it's next level, you know, But the thing is, so the movie itself becomes the means of vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still trying to wrap my head around this whole thing.
As everyone is rushing toward the doors while the place is burning down and a couple of the remaining bastards are shooting with machine guns, it's chaos in there.
Yep.
One of the lines she says is, "This is the face of Jewish vengeance," I want to say. And that's on screen. It's projected. It's 30 feet high. There's a lot of power in that.
Yeah.
And it's, I think, contributing to what Tarantino is kind of having a dialogue with here about myth-making, but also going back to those Blu-ray extras, those featurettes. There's one where Tarantino, Pitt are talking to Elvis Mitchell, the critic, and they're kind of having a roundtable about this, about the movie, and they sort of are touching on what we're touching on here. And he's talking about how he was touring this movie around. It was after Cannes and after the 11-minute standing ovation.
8 to 11 minutes.
But he said that wasn't the best showing. The best showing they had was one night in Germany.
The kindergartners?
Yeah, where they showed. They brought it to an elementary school, sat everyone down in the reading carpet. No, but they're in a German theater watching this movie with a bunch of Germans who obviously are generations removed from the Nazis, but kind of live in that shadow, and every Nazi movie that you see through the eyes of guilt.
Which is what The Reader was about, which also made me think about this a little bit.
100%.
Go ahead.
You're watching through the eyes of shame and guilt, and that's, these movies are very heavy, and it's a somber experience. And he said he's noticing that as they're watching this, at the beginning, you hear some giggles. And then as the movie's going on, people are starting to laugh a little more full. He said by the end, people are like cheering and cracking up in some of these moments of violence. And it's almost like the irreverence of the style, the revisionist take, is giving them the freedom to sort of say, I can have fun with it. It's about World War II, but I'm allowed to.
It's cathartic in some way.
Yes, there's a catharsis
but
to it.
Is that good? I mean, do we want to be laughing about massacres? What's so funny about that? Or is it because it's a moot point because it's fictional?
Yes.
We can laugh about fictional violence, but not about real violence. Is this real violence or is this not real violence? Because it's about World War II. I mean, millions and millions of people really did die.
Yeah. But the people who killed them are the ones getting killed here. So it's like the violence that's being doled out by Pitt's crew and by Shoshana is almost, quote, for the right reasons.
Yeah, which
is that almost supposed to make us feel better?
Which is almost why it sort of has to be about World War II, or it complicates in some ways our emotions about the violence, because we feel sort of okay about, you know, the ultimate bad guys getting their comeuppance.
The recontextualizing, I think it's... It goes back to that idea of, if we're able to watch this and not feel bad about it, is that better, being able to remember something the way that we want to remember it rather than the way that it actually happened?
Or is he just love those like gut punches that you get, the visceral reactions to violence, and this was a way to just have as much as you want, because it's not so bad because it's just Nazis.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is, that's there a little bit in the style, because this is a comedy in somewhat. but the inclusion of that Nazi soldier not being able to watch the movie of his own life, I think, because it kind of shows us that we can celebrate and we can glorify stories of violence, but the reality of violence is not glamorous. And there's a line there between, you know, how you experience it and how you depict / remember it.
I think that in a way he's using the same kind of response that people have had to slapstick. I mean, go back to Charlie Chaplin, people falling on their face. Sometimes watching like old time cartoons, they're pretty violent, like a anvil landing on someone's head, you know? And I mean, it's just like hilarious to little kids, but somehow when I've seen some clips of that, you know, recently, I'm kind of like, wow, this is a little more brutal than I really remember. And I mean, I remember liking it as a kid too.
You don't like seeing Tom and Jerry hit each other with mallets. I mean, I've laughed pretty hard when I've seen you step on a rake and then it comes up, flies and hits you in the face.
Fortunately, missed my nose.
Barely.
So I think that in a way, laughing about, there is some kind of release about the violence that it's sort of like, it's so uncomfortable that you laugh about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the real accomplishment of this movie is what a lot of great art does. And, you know, maybe someone would criticize me for saying this movie itself is great art.
Those people are wrong.
But, the fact that you can have all of that going on at once and have multiple readings possible about the same movie, it means that it kind of lives on, you know?
Yeah.
And like what you're saying, you have Hitler busting a gut and then you have the actual, you know, killer or the killer from the movie itself.
Mm-hmm.
And he's squirming about his own deeds.
Yeah.
Are those contradictory? Is that like Tarantino can't make up his own mind about this? Or is that just like, you know what? Violence is complicated. Dealing with it afterward is complicated. And, you know, sometimes how you experience it one way is different from how you experience it another way with some distance. And all that is just crammed into the same movie. And mm-hmm. I think that is, to me, that's an accomplishment of this movie.
Yeah.
And although some of the scenes, I have to say, on my ClearPlay version were truncated.
I bet. But
I saw a bat at one point swinging towards someone's head, and then it cut
to a different 20 scene. Minutes ahead in the movie.
No,
I mean, I think everything that we're talking about is not an accident because he did make Kill Bill before this, and there's none of that in Kill Bill Volume 1. It's just
there's
like...
There's no Nazi question marks and things like
there's
that.
There's no gray area with morality. It's that you've been wronged and now you're on a revenge spree, and it's supposed to be like cool and fun and cathartic because it's not real. At no point in that movie do you ever feel like people who are getting chopped up by swords had a family and, you know... How are we supposed to feel about Uma Thurman doing all this? It's a style thing.
What about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I've only seen that once.
It's been a little...
So it's harder for me to...
Yeah, same talk. Here. I'm looking forward to revisiting that one.
Yeah, same.
It's that one's very interesting because I feel like the first 2 hours are kind of like a fairly traditional feeling movie. And then it goes into like the last act and it feels more like this.
Mm-hmm.
It feels more like a, you know, Tarantino... Craziness going on.
And he's obviously very interested in this idea of, you know, giving retribution to people who never really got it, mm-hmm. you know, in real life. And Django Unchained comes after this. And then
I still haven't seen
Once
that
Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Okay. So one question I have, this is a quote from Tarantino. He said, "I won't be period specific about the movie. I'm not just going to play a lot of Edith Piaf and Andrew Sisters. I can have rap. I can do whatever I want. It's about filling in the viscera." So why is Tarantino, what is he doing here when he's clashing the cultures and putting, you know, music that doesn't seem to match the, he's not the only person who's ever done this, but
no.
Matching where the music is clearly mismatched with the time period and you mm-hmm. know, it's anachronistic.
Yeah.
So why does he do that, you think?
I mean, I think first it's whatever music feels right in the scene, because this is somebody who obviously thinks a lot about pacing. His movies move, you know, they're brisk. I think the other part of it is that if he was trying to make a straight period piece that was very true to life, then we wouldn't be having all these other discussions about, you know, how you revise history and, you know, play with the morality. The morality would be very simplistic, because we'd be talking about Nazis bad, they're doing this thing and we're learning something from it, or grappling. We're not really grappling with the past in the same way in a movie like this as we are in The Reader, which can't just come out playing you know, a rap song.
That would be an interesting... there are some people who are critical of using World War II here.
I'm sure.
Daniel Mendelsohn was critical of the depiction of Jews and the revisionist history. He said, "Do you really want audiences cheering for a revenge that turns Jews into carbon copies of Nazis? that makes Jews into sickening perpetrators. He says, I'm not so sure. So the brutality of Jews exacting their revenge being, you know, just as bad as the brutality of the Nazis against them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What does that, is that part of the complication, or you think that that's not a, not something to worry about?
Can I say both? I do think that it's both. I don't disagree with him because I thought the same thing while watching, and Aldo and Landa are, they're not foils. They're the same person on the on opposite sides of a party line. That's kind of the only difference between them. And they're both trying to spread reputation the same way. They're both using brutal tactics the same way. Except the difference is we side with Pitt because he's going after the Nazis who they got no humanity, which we have to agree with. But I don't know. I never really landed on in a place that I feel 100% comfortable in what I think Tarantino's really trying to say about our response to violence. I'm not really sure.
I'm not sure, again, what his response is to World War II. Here's another critic that was, you know, had an issue. He, Jonathan Rosenbaum, the critic, he equated this movie to a form of Holocaust denial. Basically, like, you know, the entertaining aspects, the silliness in some ways. Here's what he said later. It makes the Holocaust harder, not easier to grasp as a historical reality, insofar as it becomes a movie convention, by which I mean a reality derived only from other movies, it loses its historical reality, unquote. I think that making light of the Holocaust is a very fine line to tread also. I mean, how much laughing do we really want to do about this, you know, the greatest atrocity, you know, that's ever been, that's ever happened. And there actually are Holocaust deniers. You know, there are people who think it didn't happen, or that it was some conspiracy and that the Jews are really still to blame. And there's anti-Semitism still going on today in our society. And so, kind of using this as a backdrop, just kind of almost conveniently talk about movie violence or that, I can kind of see why there's some challenge there for people. I'm not really sure if in his quest to be, to make a masterpiece, he thought making about World War II, which so many great movies have been made about World War II, he's like, well, I'm going to jump into that World War II arena.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's like even on his mind anywhere. This is Tarantino. Like, he breaks every rule that he wants. Maybe that's a way to kind of thumb his nose at the establishment and say, well, I'm going to make a World War II movie then too.
Yeah. If
is that
anything,
on his mind, or what?
I don't think that jumping into the arena because these movies are taken more seriously is in his mind. I think if anything, it's in his mind that all of these movies have a relatively similar tone. They're all approached in a relatively similar way. Even the reader that is kind of, it's looking at the Holocaust in such a different, almost detached way, still feels like a Holocaust movie. And if anything, maybe he was just wanting to make a movie that is set during World War II and during the Holocaust that doesn't feel like it's a part of that bucket in some kind of way. Because I don't see him making light of the Holocaust here. I see him making fun of Nazis. And that's very different. You know, we never go to a camp. And if we did, then it would be really hard to not be uncomfortable, I think, in a scene like that. But then, I don't know, maybe he would do it a certain way where they rise up and
I think,
and even that's part of the retribution angle. I'm not sure.
I think that the intensity of that last scene with the fury and the vengeance in the eyes of Shoshana up on that big screen and those flames coming up, it's almost like this biblical, you know, righteous indignation also, that, you know, I'm going to destroy the wicked is almost kind of what it feels like.
And
in that sense, I think that it's not making light of it. I think it's like, it's a pretty fascinating manifestation of what probably a lot of people in history have felt like. How could the Holocaust happen? And, you know, wish we could have stopped it, you know, by its own holocaust, you know, a counter holocaust with this fire going up.
And it could be that we are intellectualizing it too much. It could be that you don't feel bad about killing monsters in monster movies. And these are monsters, you know. Nazi is a shorthand for monster in a whole, I don't know, genre of movies, not even a whole lot of movies, a whole genre of them. And so it could
just... Indiana Jones, from Indiana Jones to Hellboy, you know?
to Dead Snow, where they play their zombies. It's like Nazi zombie, that's a double. You can do whatever you want to a zombie, and you can do whatever you want to a Nazi. You put it together, and you have the perfect target. So I'm not sure. But do you have a favorite scene in this movie?
I mean, that one with the film at the end was big. But I think that because Tarantino has such like a postmodernist, you know, disrupt every expectation, it was interesting to watch the first scene.
Yeah.
This is not a postmodernist scene. This is like, I'm Tarantino and I can also do this.
Yeah.
You know, give me all the basic rules of how you're supposed to make a movie. I'm going to follow all those and make it as intense, as fast as you can imagine it. And that first scene where, you know, they're talking in French, and there's all these little, you know, the way it escalates, and that I think is so masterful.
Yeah.
And then it switches gears so dramatically when Aldo Rain is introduced. Mm-hmm. But it kind of just, it's kind of like a virtuoso directing job.
Yeah.
With everything going back and forth. I also, there's one moment of Christopher Waltz's performance that I thought lifted it to the level of Academy Award, top acting to me. I'm not going to say Academy Award equals the best, because why would we be on the show if we didn't have that?
Right.
But when Christopher Waltz is like talking to Aldo Rain, who is supposedly Italian, he's speaking the worst Italian accent you could even imagine. And Christopher Waltz, he recognizes it, and he has the whole thing figured out without, nobody has to explain it to him. He knows exactly what's going on. And the laugh that he gives there is like a giggle. Like he is ecstatic that he now has just outed everybody. And not only that, but he's also probably calculated his own path out of this whole thing. That moment where I think it's just incredible acting. It's like an interpretation on the script that very few people I think would ever do. And whether that was Tarantino saying, here's how you have to do it, I'm sure he did in part because he wrote it and directed it. But the way Christopher Waltz pulled that off, I thought was also very memorable.
He's so good. He's so good in it. When he asks Von Hammersmark, you know, oh, how'd you break your leg? And she says, rock climbing. He just dies laughing. Oh, rock climbing. Okay. But yeah, that first scene, not only is the dialogue just so good, the scene is so tense.
It's economical. It's
so cinematic too, how when he decides to show us them sitting underneath the
floorboards. Going below the floorboards. You had no idea they were under there.
Yeah.
And it's just at the exact moment when it's the worst possible thing
and
to see.
Then you realize why they switched languages. And it's like, that's a thing that he carries through the rest of the movie, weaponizing language in that way. It's you have to be able to speak multiple different languages in order to sort of get behind enemy lines and be a spy in any certain scenario. And we see that again, that in that tavern scene, that's like 30 minutes long of just people sitting at tables and talking. But man, I love that scene too. It might be one of my favorites.
Michael Fassbender is really good in that.
Yes, where it's just kind of all about, we weren't expecting these Nazis to be in the bar. This was only supposed to be a meetup with this double agent. And now they're here and we have to pretend like, you know, we belong here. And are they suspicious of us? And why are they suspicious? Is it just because they're drunk, or do they know who we are? And then they would, you know, people would tell a joke and you don't know, are they diffusing the situation because they don't suspect, or are they trying to make us uncomfortable by diffuse? It's so, so good. And then at the end, when he kind of gives it away by holding up three fingers for the glasses, it's like,
Yep.
There's so much happening in between the words,
mm-hmm.
and it's legit like 30 minutes long. I don't know how you hold that kind of tension for for that long, and then obviously it explodes into action. But I think the first scene and the second scene, which apparently he wrote 10 years before the rest of the movie, I thought was kind of interesting.
He was trying to do this before Kill Bill and just couldn't quite work it out. And then he switched gears and went to Kill Bill and he did the Grindhouse, his half of Grindhouse, and then kind of finally came back to this. But it's interesting. So this was ruminating for quite a while.
Yeah. So those first two chapters, Marinating. I think, are great. And then that tavern scene is maybe my third favorite overall. And the Mike Myers scene, obviously, my least favorite.
Mike Myers. Perfect casting job for this. Christopher Hitchens, the journalist, he really didn't like this movie at all. And here's how he described it. It was like sitting in the dark, having a great pot of warm piss emptied very slowly over your head, unquote.
What?
So interesting. Some people didn't like it too much.
I guess not. I mean, that's the thing. When you take big risks like this and you take big swings, I'm surprised it got nominated for an Oscar because of that.
What genre is this?
I don't know. I don't know. It
doesn't really work in a genre. I think that's the thing. Tarantino like has his own genre, it feels like. Ready for a little trivia?
Yeah, hit me.
Okay, so most of the bride's attributes from Kill Bill came from his original idea for Shoshana. And then he put that aside, and it'll change a lot of change in the 10 years between, but he eventually just making that Shoshana version into the bride for Kill Bill. The director Enzo G. Castellaria, who did the 1978 Inglourious Basterds, he makes a cameo at the film premiere.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Yep. He says, and that's the same line he says in his movie when he makes a cameo.
Very cool. Tarantino originally wanted Leonardo DiCaprio as Londa, who went to Christopher Waltz.
Wow. Huh.
It's hard to imagine anyone doing it because he really gets that role.
Yeah. And you have to be able to speak fluently in both languages and sell it. And even if Leo could learn the language, I'm not sure that we would ever see him as anything but Leonardo DiCaprio.
I know.
It's such an American presence, you know?
Well, it's interesting how that happens because, again, I think Tarantino plays with the movie star, you know, power. Like Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio are in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, 10 years later or so. And I think that because they're big movie stars, it helps that movie quite a bit. And this one maybe distracts. But what about Brad Pitt? He's a big deal, but he's
an American presence, and he's playing a guy who is the most American guy ever. You know, he comes.
Brad Pitt's the most American guy ever, or Aldo Rain is the most American guy ever.
Aldo Rain is the most American guy ever. He says, well, you know, I got a little engine blowed in me.
I think he's a little backward for being the most American. I mean, Abraham Lincoln's the most American guy ever.
Even in his Hawaiian shirt, really?
Eli Roth said that they almost got incinerated during the fire scene. The projected fire was supposed to burn at 400, but instead it burned at 1200. And there's a swastika that was on steel cables and they burned. They weren't supposed to, but they softened and they snapped and the swastika fell.
Wow.
So pretty dangerous. Dealing with that much fire.
Also apparently directed the Nation's Pride movie.
Isn't that weird?
That you see little chunks of.
I read that too. Isn't that weird? Like, how did that conversation happen? Well, we need this other black and white, you know, fake movie within the movie.
Just do it.
Eli, why don't you direct that?
Yeah.
Interesting. So on the BBC show, The Graham Norton Show, Tarantino was on in 2013 and he talks about, so I'm trying to get this right. Kruger, that's the woman, let's see.
Kruger?
Yeah. Who is this? Hold on a second.
Oh, he's typing.
I'm typing. Yeah. Diane Kruger. But who did she play? Oh yeah. Bridget von Hammersmark.
Mm.
So she's getting strangled, in the
movie.
Another
great scene.
And he says that, he personally strangled her with his bare hands in one take. to aid authenticity. How do you feel about that? You like those authentics? I know you like those authentic touches.
I don't even understand the quote, to be honest. To aid authenticity?
Because
somebody else's hands wouldn't have been authentic?
Because he really wanted to look real, that, you know, maybe he has a lot of practice strangling people.
Maybe he has a thing for strangling women.
So we know that Mike Myers was in it. BJ Novak didn't have, this is all pre-Office for BJ Novak?
Mm.
Or is that still happening?
I don't know about that. I think The Office was out.
Anyway, right now. Interesting that he's got these people in here, but he wanted Adam Sandler to be in this movie also, but he declined due to scheduling conflicts with funny people.
Yeah, The Office was 05.
Why does he have these people in there?
Jewish people. Come on. I really do think that's kind of as basic as it is.
Adam Sandler.
I mean, Pitt says in the first speech he gives that he's putting together a team, and he specifies a Jewish-American team.
He should have had Harrison Ford in there. He's one quarter Jewish. Not too shabby. Okay, so that's basically all the trivia that I got.
Hanukkah song. How many times have I laughed at the Hanukkah song in the past like 20 years? Still hasn't gotten old.
So keep it or kick it.
So the last line of this movie is, I think this might just be my masterpiece. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it's not.
Tarantino's best movie?
I don't know if I'm ready to definitively say that, but I'm not sure that I'm ready to say that it's definitively not.
Better than Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction actually for me is not in my top three. I think Reservoir Dogs, I just have a soft spot for that because it's very important for getting me into movies. You know, I saw it at the right time in my life, and it just opened up a lot of stuff at the time. And there's something simple about kind of the style barrage of Kill Bill that I love, but so much of what Tarantino is good at, like the dialogue, obviously, the weird, surprising cutaways of like Sam Jackson explaining why film stock is flammable out of nowhere. I love that stuff. Then there's kind of like the Hitchcockian tension moments, like in the tavern. Like everything that I like about him is crammed into this movie.
And the movie, the obsession with the power of movies.
Yes.
Is front and center.
Yeah, it really is, on top of all the great performances here. So I don't know. It's almost like every time I see this movie, I like it more. And it's a legit contender for my one for the
year. That's an interesting recipe. Every time you watch it, you like it more. How often does that happen? Seems kind of rare to me.
Yeah, yeah.
This is also a candidate for number one for me as well. After I saw it, I was kind of like, I liked it more this time. This is the second time I've watched it. Mm-hmm. And it's a movie that I would like to watch again, you know, tomorrow. So that's, again, another kind of litmus test. When you talk about, again, my theory of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood being first 2 hours is like, you know, fairly traditional feeling movie, and then we go total Tarantino afterward. I kind of feel like that's what happens with this movie in that first chapter. Like, this is your Hollywood movie. You're watching a movie now, and then we're going to go into a crazy land.
And the fact that it's not broken into a 3X structure either. I think it's five chapters, you know, and
I'd have to analyze that more carefully.
From anything, you can see that arc, but he just lets each moment and each discussion breathe for so long. So you get these chapters where you're just meeting a guy and he's talking to somebody else. And so much of the drama of the scene is also kind of about learning how this character improvises and reacts and all those things through discussions and secrets. And that's great.
If I say that it's a candidate for one, then it's pretty sure bet that it'll be in my five. So I'm going to say keep it.
Yeah.
And in the next episode, we will talk about War as a Drug, The Hurt Locker, Catherine Bigelow's Best Picture winner, starring Jeremy Renner.
Until then, find us on social media or wherever you listen to podcasts. And for 16 years of golden takes, head over to letterboxd.com/Mike Cavalieri.
If you want to support the show or pick a bonus episode, visit patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
Thanks to WNZF and the illustrious Mark Gilliland for producing. Also, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the show.
Thanks for listening to Best Picture This, the 8 to 11 minute standing ovation of film criticism.